Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hey everybody, what is up? I am Chad Wesley Smith. This is another episode of the Jug Life Podcast, joined as always by the notorious MAX, Max Ada, and a very, very special guest. Thankful to have him here, Mr. Stan Efferding. How you doing, buddy?
Good. Thanks for inviting me. You could have gotten a bigger table. We're hanging off the ends here, trying to squeeze in. It's only a six-footer.
Max has got a lot of shoulder girth to him, among other girths, but...
Well, thank you.
We said we weren't going to go dick.
Yeah, it's all Stan. Stan pulled that out of all of us right there.
But yeah, very excited to have Stan here. Yeah, he's been someone we look up to for lifting, business, all that stuff. So excited to learn some things. Before we get into it, thank you to the sponsors. Virus International, use Jug for 10% off. Grind Sports Nutrition, Jug 10 for 10% off. Trifecta Nutrition, if you want to get great tasting food delivered right to your door, the trifectanutrition.com/juggernaut. And waffles and weighted carries. It's the lifestyle. So as we get into things here, what we want to talk about first is Stan the man, not just the lifter, not the rhino, but find out how Stan Efferding turned into the rhino. So
yeah, he started out as the flamingo. Yeah. He did. May have seen some pictures on my social media of my massive quadriceps when I was first started training. I was all of 130 pounds when I got to college, just a strapping young lad. And my soccer coach told me I had to go lift weights. I wasn't big enough to play soccer. You may have heard that one before.
You know you're skinny if you're not big enough for soccer.
That's rough. Yeah, and like a lot of
same height as you are now, weighing 130.
Yeah, 6 foot, 130. Yeah, 135 pounds as a freshman.
What are you now? Buck 50?
60? Yeah, I'm up to about a buck 50 now. It was a long road. I've made massive progress.
Hard gainer.
Yeah,
hard gainer. Well, you don't want to get fat, so you're always cutting to make sure you keep your abs, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to go up.
You want a six-pack year-round and be able to squat 900. But both of those things they fit in the same plan. Well, I just started lifting, and I kind of liked the results that I got, even though they were very minor at the time, considering. And, you know, we didn't have the internet back then, so the guy behind the desk at the gym was usually your source of information, and a horrendous source. You know, because that's the guy that's dieting for a show on chicken breasts and broccoli.
Right.
And you can't figure out why you're not growing when you're eating his food, his tuna out of the can.
He was probably 10 weeks out from Junior Nats.
Yeah, something like that.
Every bodybuilder is 10 weeks out from Junior Nats.
Right. And then you pick up a copy of Arnold Schwarzenegger's Encyclopedia of Bodybuilding, and you proceed to train 4 hours a day, seven days a week. And after your joints start screaming and you haven't gained but, you know, a pound in 6 months, you're starting to think this maybe isn't the sport for you. But fortunately, you do come across, or did come across at the time, some people who had a better plan, and that was to eat more and train less. And I've really kind of stuck with that theory throughout most of my career, is trying to recover more. But that's, you know, mainly because I'm an ectomorph, and the more I train, the harder it is to eat enough to maintain size. And I was always shooting as a small guy to become a pro bodybuilder. You know, we didn't have physique and classic bodybuilding and those kinds of things back then. So you had to be 250 plus pounds at my height on stage. And if you wanted to be a power lifter, you know, you needed to be pretty big and heavy and strong to do that as well. So there was only one real goal back then, and that was just to get as big and strong as possible, as quickly as possible. And, you know, I just found that the fastest way there was lots and lots of food and lots of rest. And so I always go back to that, the fundamentals in my program.
Well, I know Max was telling me an impressive Stan Efferding eating story that he had.
Yeah, that was one of the – I think it was probably – I probably met you already through Mark. But Mark told me a story about the first time – maybe one of the first times you had come out to Sacramento to train, about like a one-pound hamburger that ended up turning into like – a couple, three one-pound hamburgers?
Yeah, I just sometimes I would forage, you know, just eat as much as I could at one sitting. But mostly I've been kind of a eat as much as I can throughout the course of the day. Not quantity, but frequency.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I've always been a big fan of taking in a lot of red meat. Hamburger hasn't always been my primary choice, but it was more affordable, obviously. But steak, Flex had me eating well over 4 pounds of steak a day while I was dieting for a show. And over 800 grams of carbs. So eating has always been huge for me.
How long did you go, like, from day one of the gym till, you know, maybe the first year or so, you're just kind of doing whatever you hear, you know, someone telling you, or just screwing around? That screwing around point, once that kind of ends and you decide, like, now I'm going to try and, you know, you buy the book, whatever, you're doing that stuff. How long did you, like, do it wrong before you finally connected with people that kind of helped you?
Well, I've said, I knew then what I know now.
Right.
I'd have been able, I think, to have done a lot more a lot sooner in life rather than having to spend the better part of my early 40s trying to relive my youth with a better brain and more knowledge. But it's over 3 years is the answer to that question.
Okay.
I competed in my first show. After 3 years of training, I was 158 pounds. And that's 6 days a week, sometimes twice a day training, because I thought that's how you built muscle.
Right, right.
You know, you lift weights, so your muscles grow, right?
Yeah.
That was my theory at the time, anyhow. And so I wasn't a fast gainer, and I wasn't very strong either. And neither of those things had developed until after I figured out how to train less and eat more.
Right.
So it was when you started lifting, and soccer was what spurred it. But right away, you were training for bodybuilding with the goal, not with, I need to get bigger so I can play soccer anymore.
Yeah, I had a scholarship offer to play soccer, but after that summer that I spent training, I told my coach I'm not coming back. I figured out what I wanted to do. I wanted to bodybuild.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I saw the guys in the magazines. And I, you know, it's unfortunate with social media, and the internet's great. It provides you a lot of information, gives you a lot of you know, people to model yourself after or aspire to, but it's also full of a lot of naysayers. And back then, of course, you only had your circle of friends. You didn't have people chiming up from their mom's basement telling you that you're never going to be this, you're never going to be that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I didn't really receive a lot of negative feedback for a long time. I was all lost in my own little world of positive, you know, thoughts about becoming a pro bodybuilder someday. Nobody came in and wrecked that for me when I was 158 pounds, which would have been easy to do.
Well, it's also funny because, like, I would say a lot of my whatever start in lifting was kind of similar, where I did a lot of stuff that was really, like, I look at it now and be like, I would never really have people do that. It was just kind of bizarre. It didn't work at the time, but when you're doing it and you're training 6 days a week, it doesn't really ring with you that, like, there's a better way. You just kind of... That's what you're doing, right? And you want to work hard. You want to put all your effort into it. And so the connection that, like, oh, this may be, like, kind of counterintuitive, like, if I back off on the training and I eat more, doesn't connect initially where it's like, oh, yeah, like, that makes sense. Because you're a kid and you're training and you know, you just kind of keep going with that. But then at some point you kind of have that moment where you realize, like, or someone helps you or some mentor comes along.
I know for Max and I both, I mean, I started training hard when I was about 14 and you were, what, 12,
12 13?
It's very hard to understand the concept of, like, delayed gratification or less being more.
Yeah.
And it's like enthusiasm almost does you in.
Yeah.
You know? And I see that with a lot of new lifters now where they're so pumped up about what they're doing, and that's great, and you don't want to, you know, quell their enthusiasm for what they're doing, but it's an important distinction between doing as much as you can, that's not necessarily working as hard as possible, but working as hard as possible means being disciplined enough to maybe not do 6 days a week, but rather be disciplined in the other areas. And it seems like it was those other areas of the recovery stuff that really...
Well, the process of being successful in powerlifting, bodybuilding, Olympic lifting, and strongman really requires more than just that focus on lifting.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all the rebuilding. And now that's become more than just eating and sleeping. It's also become rehab, which is a huge component now of recovery. I was here for your seminar, and I can't remember which of the presenters said it, but he said you can train as hard and as often as that from which you can recover. And that, you know, is you couldn't put it any better than that.
Yeah.
And so when you start to realize that, and I mentioned this in a rant where I said that the more you eat and the more you sleep, the more you can train, and the more you train, the more you need to eat and the more you need to sleep, which then allows you to train more, which then, keeps going.
Yeah.
And so you just keep spiraling that up towards, being able to train as much and as hard as you possibly can, and then you become consumed by all of the obligations. The requirements to train that hard and that often are everything that you have to do outside the gym. I've said it's that you become a victim of your own circumstance. Yeah. If I want to hold on to 250 pounds of muscle, then I have to eat 6+ times a day, and I have to train every so often. It's like you're putting yourself in this in this prison almost these obligations start to fill, and every step you take towards getting better requires more commitment.
Yeah.
In some avenue, either more sleep, more food, more training, more rehab, which could include everything from, mobility and stretching to ART, whatever all goes into that.
And then those can get to the point where they become conflicting with each other because, with finite time in the day, if you can't train more because then you don't have enough time to eat, sleep, recover, and, finding that Dr. Mike Isertel is probably the one who was talking about it in that seminar. We talk a lot about the idea of maximum recoverable volume. That maybe could you do more training? Yes, but would it be something that you're able to recover from and be useful to you? And we've gone on now to even expand the idea of MRV to now talk about MAV, maximum adaptable volume. That not just the most that you could possibly do and come back to survive the next workout, but to have enough in the enough resources to be able to recover and improve upon that.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't have all these fancy names for it when I was growing up. We just called it failure, and we called it eating. Now there's all these other little names for it. But I think it's been great for the sport for people to be able to understand how important those things are now. And that what you see is younger and younger kids. And when I say kids, I still mean, late teens, early 20s, doing some pretty incredible things.
Yeah.
I've joked now that kids in elementary school and recess are going out and deadlifting 800 pounds.
Yeah.
That used to be a big deal.
Well, we just actually, I guess earlier today or last night, not our time, but CJ Cummings, 16 years old, broke the youth world record in the clean and jerk with 185 kilos, so like 407 pounds, weighing 147. 152?
69 kilos. 154,
No, it's ridiculous what they're able to do now.
That's insane.
And part of that also is that the sport has, all these sports have become more popular just in the last 6-7 years. And, of course, then you start to get these outliers. And these people who may never have been interested in picking up a weight before have discovered they have a particular talent. And they talk about it now in the UFC with men's fighting. We've seen that now to where there's not a – all those guys are extraordinarily talented.
Right.
And it's starting to happen in women's fighting.
Yeah.
Look at what's happened recently with the new champion that's taken over for Ronda Rousey. They've gotten better.
Yeah.
And in 5 years, they'll be even better.
Yeah.
And you look now at women's physique competitors, in which was just a new sport like 6 years ago. I think they just brought it on. The women who turned pro 6 years ago wouldn't even place today.
Yeah.
Because more and more people are getting involved, and you see that with these young kids in powerlifting and strongman and Olympic lifting, et cetera. And now you're starting to find the outliers, the Jesse Norrises of the world, the Larry Wheels of the world, who you may never have seen before because they'd be playing football or doing something else.
Our friend Greg Knuckles actually had a post about this kind of recently, and he...
I can't say anything without Greg already have written about it.
Yeah.
And he had a big graph, and it was comparing all these powerlifting results. I think all IPF results from 7 years ago and now, and the distribution of it was very similar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the same kind of bell curve of results, but instead of three guys being in the top, you know, 5% of it, now it was 50.
Yeah.
And
it's ridiculous.
Pretty, even looking at my own powerlifting career, you know, I think you and I kind of started in powerlifting and raw powerlifting about the same time, much more on the forefront of things. I did my first meet in 2010.
Yeah.
And I made 1962 as a 308 in reps.
Yeah.
And that at the time tied me for the number two U.S. total at 308s. And my next meet, I did 2165, and then that was the number two total in the world at 308s. Milanichev was like 2350-ish, and then I was at 2165. And now you get guys, I mean, Larry Wheels, for example, doing 2170 in sleeves at 60 pounds less body weight.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I squatted 800 the first time, I was like, oh, my God, 800-pound squat in knee wraps.
Yeah.
I was like 198s. Doing that, maybe 181's doing that.
Yeah, and there's specialists in each of those, whether it be deadlift, bench, or squat, that that are popping up everywhere. Names you never heard of.
Yeah,
400 followers on Instagram.
Yeah,
you know, smashing. Yeah. These
oh, there was that guy recently.
Pulled
900.
Yeah, Kaler.
Callum
Willier.
See, there's my point. Yeah.
You know? We don't even know his name.
Yeah.
We're in this thing all the time.
And you feel bad about it because
the
guy kicked your ass.
Yeah.
You know, he just kill you with the on the deadlift, but.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is there are starting to be enough that they're not all really recognized right away. It'd be
interesting to see where we're at in, like, let's say 15 years when, or 20 years, or whatever that is, when that talent pool is finally kind of, we've reached the depth of that, and we've found the most talented people, and there's 20 or 30 of these top guys. You'll probably start to see the most, the because talent alone won't get you to the top of that top five.
You'll see these. You know, it remains to be seen yet what the longevity is of that. Because, and some of this has to do with the athlete themselves, you know, setting records every weekend on Instagram.
Right.
It's the nature of the beast right now.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily make money on the sport.
Right.
But you can make money.
You kind of have to perform a little bit.
Yes.
Right?
If you can bring in enough eyeballs, then you have some value as a marketing tool. And how do you bring in those eyeballs? You know, you throw up some huge numbers.
Yeah.
And so that's happening every weekend. Then we start getting some injuries.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of the guys you just mentioned a minute ago have suffered through. Dan suffered through some significant injuries. Eric Lillibridge suffered through some significant injuries. As relatively young athletes in the sport have endured some muscle tears and pulls and surgeries. And, so it remains to be seen whether or not you know, I always go back and look at and talk about Eddie Cohn when I'm talking to these great lifters. Somebody who only competed twice a year.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mikhail Kokolev talked about how they only max out twice a year
at
the national championships and world championships. And at the qualifiers for those, they're only in the low to mid 90 percentiles.
Yeah.
So that becomes, you know, part of whether or not you have, I think, the long vision. Or the discipline, maybe, to where you can hold back a little bit. The Russians have that long-term view. They look at a 10-year plan.
Yeah.
You know, we look at, well, in 3 months, I got to meet.
Right.
It's exciting
for
us.
It's Friday.
We're all in a
I
got to
post something good this week.
You know? And I'm no different. I'm not talking, you know, about anybody in any particular way.
No.
I'm saying that
it's
I
just
tried
the culture,
to lift as
right?
much as I could, as often as I
could.
The fact that I competed in both bodybuilding and powerlifting was almost a self-metering process for me.
Right.
Because I was only doing one, maybe two powerlifting meets a year. Because then I would switch and do one or two bodybuilding shows a year.
That's smart.
And that's kind of the way that Eddie Cohn, without, you know, the bodybuilding competition, designed his long-term plan was to do some hypertrophy training in the off-season and to let his body rest and let his central nervous system rest and then ramp up so that over the course of 20 years he goes from 165 to 242, setting records, you know, all throughout his career.
Sure.
So it can be a career, but we got to be cautious about how we manage that.
Well, I see that a lot in our dealings with USAPL stuff. And, Marissa just broke the world record, 114's total record. She told 948 at 114, and she'll turn 41 in July.
Yeah.
And in the same meet, the Grand Prix at the Arnold, Dave Ricks, who is 57 years old, broke the open world record in the squat, the IPF open world record in the squat, squatted like It was 3:30, I think. 3:30. Yeah, 7:27 at 2:05. 57 years old. Tony Harris was taking shots at the squat record at over 50 years old. The guys who have been competing for 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, 30 going on 40 years.
Yeah. But I bet they didn't do 200 meets.
No.
You know. Yeah. We just talked about that with respect to the strongmen, and they tend to have a pretty aggressive schedule.
Right.
And they suffer a significant amount of injuries as a result of that schedule. Yeah. So it could be a better idea for longevity, and the reason being is because I do think, at least it was my experience, that I was stronger at 40 than I was at 25,
mm-hmm.
and significantly so. And it may be that tendon and ligament strength that is slower to earn that provided me that opportunity. But you know, I would like to see people be able to realize that. Now, I think I was north of what's safe. I've often said that I probably pushed that window of opportunity a little further than I should have.
Right.
When I was still competing up 44, 45 in terms of the volumes that I was doing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and also, again, depends on what you do to compete, how much weight you carry, whether or not performance-enhancing drugs are involved, and to what extent. Those things all play a factor in, I think, your... what would you call it, your life in the sport, your competitive ability. I can't anymore if I wanted to. You know, you see a guy squatting 700-some pounds at 57, and I'm like, damn, 57. And I start thinking, sure, I might be able to do that. Yeah. But what you have to do to get there, can you do it safely?
Yeah.
You know, can you do it without getting injured? And
that was one thing that was always interesting to me, and it was kind of – it was kind of corroborated by Kokliev when he came here, which was, you know, he was talking about the cultural difference between in Russia and the U.S., and he was kind of making this reference that in Russia it was like if someone's sick, right, or in the U.S., if somebody is sick, you have a cold, it's like, okay, give me all the cold, and like, whatever it is, give me the NyQuil, the this, the that, just take all of it and get it out of the way. Right. He said in Russia it's like, okay, like, I'll take time off from my job, I'll sit down, I'll have this tea, I'll do this, like, kind of, like, whatever, you know, hot shower, bath, kind of, some
home
remedy, but very, like, moderate, very little.
You treat yourself well.
And then he's saying, like, you know, in training, it's the same thing. It's like, in training in the U.S., it's this mentality of every day is this war, and you're going in, and if you don't smash the weights and just obliterate everything every that day, it's you didn't train hard. And in Russia, he said, you go in, it's all about, like, you know, we're just building and building and building, right? The analogy he used was really good. He said, training in Russia is like sex without climax. So you're always kind of in this place where you're enticing the results out of yourself rather than trying to just, you know, get blood from a rock, right?
Right.
You're coming in, you're training to get better, and then the stuff outside of that, the other things all sort of build on themselves so that, you know, after 15, 20, 30 weeks or whatever, you have this really great result rather than, you know, pretty good results in training, terrible to meet, and then it's just kind of this stagnant struggle for the rest of the year.
And he really lives that. There's a guy who's got a lot of miles on him.
Yeah,
a lot. With the strongman and the Olympic lifting, the powerlifting, all the stuff, the busy schedule that he's done, as much as he's lifted, and the injuries that he's been subjected to, who recently was in the animal cage after an injury. He was trying to slowly ramp back up.
Yeah.
And he just said, I'm this is part of my regular training schedule. Here's what I'm going to do today.
Yeah.
He had more in him. He certainly
could,
you know.
For sure.
Everybody else who lifts in the animal cage.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's, yeah.
You go and
they lose a year off their life.
You know? Yeah. That's like the highlight of your year. And me no different.
Yeah.
You know, when you go in there and if you don't almost injure yourself, you didn't try hard enough.
Right.
And then it was just a week ago, he posted another video where he was deadlifting and probably added another 100 pounds since the Arnold.
Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah. Really just very, very smooth, solid, very meticulous,
very methodical.
Yeah.
The important life lesson to take away from that all is that foreplay is very important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
All right. That was a great episode, Jack. What else? What more important thing could we teach?
Thank you to Virus International, sponsor of the Jug Life podcast. Visit virusintl.com and use JUG, J-U-G-G, for 10% off your next order.
But so you talked about, you know, waiting until your early 40s to really do all of these things that so many other people are chasing in maybe their early 20s. What were you doing between?
Well, I tried like, you know, I poured everything into trying to become a professional bodybuilder and to power lift as best I could. At the time, it wasn't terribly popular in the early 90s. I competed in the Junior Nationals. I competed in the Mr. USA. And it just wasn't there for me. I was training with an IFBB pro at the time, and there comes a point at which you look in the mirror and you look at yourself and you look at the guy standing next to you and you say, maybe I'm just not cut out for this. You know,
these things and it's, yeah, is not like the other.
And it's exactly how it felt, you know, right. To be next to somebody who has that gift, who also trained very, very hard. And we trained hard together for many years.
Yeah.
I think that Flex Wheeler talked about that with his training partner, not Chris Cormier, but now I'm going to forget his name. That was terrible. But
Kevin LeBron.
No, it was Chris and Flex and shit. Well, anyhow, he didn't.
Was that friendship?
He didn't have quite the same.
He didn't remember my name most of the time we met.
He didn't have quite the same genetic gift as Flex and Chris, and so. But he kept training along with them for all those many years, but was never able to compete at the same level, even though he was doing everything they were doing.
Right, right.
Exactly. Day in, day out, everything they were doing, and I was in the same boat. But my training partner sometime would come in after being up till 4 a.m. drinking. And 2 hours of sleep, you'd come to the gym at 7 o'clock in the morning, just sweating alcohol and drinking a big gulp cup full of coffee and a couple of stimulants just to get through the workout. And I was the guy who was in bed by 10 o'clock every night,
right.
Never missed a meal, never missed a workout. And you would see there are certain people that have that genetic predisposition that reigns supreme in terms of your ability to add strength or add muscle, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I tried as hard as I could for as long as I could, also understanding it was never going to be a career.
Right.
And it's although it's become more popular, there's a lot more eyeballs, there's a lot more people making businesses out of it, the sports themselves still don't support a lifestyle, whether it be bodybuilding or weightlifting or powerlifting or any of those. The actual checks that you get from competing.
What were you doing work-wise? I mean,
I was working. You know, I graduated from college. I got a job as a maintenance man, and I worked my way up to where I was being mentored by a real estate developer and helped him build a 200-unit community. So I started getting experience in real estate, managing real estate, and that's kind of where I started to get experience in running.
So you're saying you started in, like, a really entry-level position.
Oh, absolutely, I graduated
and you
from
just
college.
Worked, and you actually worked your way.
Took an $8-an-hour job sweeping garbage areas and plunging toilets.
It's strange that would work, that you just kind of got better and learned more things and made connections and grew it.
I keep saying that the same in bodybuilding and powerlifting and work. It's just consistency, building on itself. There's no quick fix. You start at the bottom and you slowly work your way up, and you have to be determined and have good time management skills and be consistent. And I've said that anybody who's successful in powerlifting or bodybuilding, if they would apply the same amount of discipline, time management, and consistency and commitment with the diet and the training, or just look at the hours you put in and how methodical you are about it, tracking every set and every rep and every meal and your competitions and preparing for those things, if you would put anywhere near that kind of commitment into any income-producing venture, you'd be a millionaire in 5 years. There's no question in my mind.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of, I don't say a lot, but more and more people now are doing it. They're building companies like Juggernaut. They're building companies like Mark Bell's Slingshot and Power Magazine. There's more people out there doing it because they're seeing, as with social media, it requires some consistency, discipline, and what have you. And I powerlifted up until the mid-90s. I was... I pulled 782 with no belt back in 1996, and then I didn't compete for over 10 years after that because I started my companies. And I started to build my business, and I've talked through about the fact that you can be great at anything, but you can't be great at everything. And I made a choice that if I try and do two things at once, one's going to suffer.
Yeah.
If I want to be really great at something, and I got as good as I could get at powerlifting and at bodybuilding, and I felt, you know, at the time, measuring the return on that to be negligible and deciding that probably wasn't the best path for me to build a career. Nowadays, it could possibly be. And there's people who don't even compete who use
Yeah, very true.
You know.
Yeah, the social media stuff has definitely made the barrier to entry much lower.
Yeah, and it can be good and bad. Yeah. You know, it provides more opportunity for more people. Some of them are very highly qualified people that you know have earned it and deserve it, and some of them are just better at marketing. You know, look at what Bill Phillips did with Muscle Media Magazine and EAS supplements way back when with the 90-day challenge, et cetera, et cetera. Bill wasn't a pro bodybuilder.
Yeah,
you know, he wasn't a world record powerlifter. He was a damn good businessman, and he built a you know a huge business off of that.
Yeah,
very successful.
Listening to his podcast with Mark, and he was talking about he would be at these expos, you know, when the Arnold was so much smaller than it is now, and because he had done the direct mail newsletters, people would come up to him and introduce himself and be like, "Oh yeah, you're Stan Efferding, 23 Bluebird Lane."
Yeah,
and they're like, "Yeah, that's where," like, just because he had written it so many times, you know, as these guys
that's cool
had been subscribed to his newsletter.
That to me is cool because that's something that I think is probably true in all of business and all of the lifting stuff is that, and a lot like you talked about, like you start as a maintenance man, but people want to skip that work, that step of like, oh, well, like I get what you're saying. You got to be able to do the work.
Yeah.
But it's like the fact that Bill Phillips was actually mailing them himself and that he was totally willing to do that and probably was enthusiastic about, you know, building his business and putting the work in to get to that level.
Yeah.
Same with coaching or training or any of those lifting. You know, if you don't actually have the willingness and the effort and put it in the steps year after year after year, you're not going to have the success at the top because you don't have that foundation of work ethic and you know, you're just kind of looking for that. There's a lot of people looking for that very quick sort of like, I'll take the shortcut because everyone's figured out the formula. I'll just copy the end of the formula.
It's not there.
Right?
No
there
easy.
Isn't, right?
There's
it's
no
just
easy.
Work.
There's no easy business success. There's no easy sports success. It's just not there.
Yeah.
And so you do have to be consistent. You've got to look at that as a long-term plan.
Yeah.
You've got to be at least 5+ years, you know, to be really successful. It might take 10.
Yeah.
Are you willing to invest that, you know, on a consistent basis? Will you get some, so, you know, typically you'll get some good results right away. You know, that's great, but don't count on that long term. You really have to start grinding and hustling. You know, something like 97% of businesses fail in the first 5 years.
Yeah.
Grind Sports Nutrition is the official supplement provider of Team Juggernaut. Designed by Renaissance Periodization, there are no-nonsense supplements to fuel your hardest training. Use JUG10 at grindsupplements.com. Well, speaking of business success, you've recently continued to grow your own business success with the cooler. I'm sure so many people watching have seen, you know, saw the episode or have seen it on YouTube since your appearance on Shark Tank.
Yeah.
Tell us I mean, how that came about and what the experience was like.
That was another one of those deals where, you know, when you have a business, you have to constantly market, no matter what the business is.
Right.
Constantly market. If you're a personal trainer, you need to constantly market.
Yeah.
You know, you have to always replace, you know, the business that drops off. And when you're selling something, T-shirts, hats, whatever, you have to constantly market, whether it be social media as your platform or whether you're out knocking on doors and trying to get retailers to take your product. And so with the cooler, you know, I was just promoting it as best I could, getting on Mark's show, coming in and meeting with you guys and going to the Arnold, going to the Olympia, and just out doing the circuit, trying to make sure I was you know, consistently, you know, getting eyeballs to see the product. And then that was just one of many opportunities that came up, many doors that I knocked on, and I just went down and did it.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't worry about whether or not I would get on the show. That wasn't the goal. The goal was just to go out and try.
What is that process like?
Well, you show up for, say, a live casting call, a live audition, and it's just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people lined up in rows and sitting behind a desk or four desks at the front of the auditorium or wherever they're at is representatives from Shark Tank listening to your pitch. You get 1 minute.
Yeah.
And right behind you is 100 other people with their product and their minute. And you come up and you do your little pitch and says, thank you. And she writes a couple things. Bye. And you walk out.
Yeah.
I don't tell you anything. You don't know anything.
Right.
You know, the guy who talks to you beforehand says that, you know, if you don't hear from us, then you're not going to hear from us.
Right.
It's really that simple. And if your phone rings, great, but that doesn't mean you're on the show.
Right.
That was the beginning of a three-month process whereby almost every week I had to send them another video, answer some more questions, wow. create some more, you know, submit some more paperwork, tax returns, financial statements, projections, et cetera, almost every week. And as this process progresses and they do their background research, et cetera, they're crossing people off, you know, right. the list. And they're narrowing it down, narrowing it down, narrowing it down. And they said to me every single time they asked for something, now just so you remember, this doesn't mean you're on the show.
Right.
You, we may actually invite you down to Sony Studios, and you might not pitch to the Sharks. And you might pitch to the Sharks and not get on the show.
Right.
So every step of the way, nobody was telling you anything. And so once you pitch to the Sharks, you still don't know if you're going to be on the show.
It wasn't like until you saw yourself on TV.
Because they shoot more people than they need to because there's editing and the, you know, all these other constraints. And so that gets whittled down again. And then suddenly they call you up and say, oh, you're going to be on the show next week. You're going to air next week. So it happens about like that.
Right.
But, you know, you can't really necessarily anticipate how any of that's going to happen. All you can do is participate.
Right.
You know, and I was at a seminar with Mark Bell recently, and I tell this story all the time, and it's so important that most people who have a good idea, you know, it's 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. And most people wake up with this great idea and then start thinking of all the reasons why it won't work.
Yeah.
And, you know, who cares if it works or not? Really is the point. It's much like in training, you have to create a lifestyle. You know, it's not necessarily about just the next competition. That's it. You know, that you have to actually create a lifestyle that builds on itself. So with, you know, just getting involved and just starting your project, just kicking it off, just 20 minutes a day. And that's true with anything.
Yeah.
When I took calculus in college, I got an F because I was really good in math, and I thought I could just study.
Right.
I could cram the day before the test, right? Yeah. Wake up in the morning and go take the test. So it doesn't work like that in calculus. You know, so the next term, I took both first term and second term calculus together because I had to make it up.
Right.
And I spent 30 minutes a day. I would just resolve that that's the way I was going to do this. And sure enough, I got an A in both classes.
Yeah.
30 minutes a day. You know
that's
people don't put that kind of
of
consistency and they have that vision.
It's funny. The only concept you're really talking about is practice.
Yes.
I mean, if you sat down for 20 minutes a day and practiced calculus, in a year, you'd probably be pretty good at it.
You'd be pretty good.
And it's funny because, like, you see this all the time. Chad, I'm sure, gets this question more than anything. It's like people ask the question of, like, I'm not very good at this, that, and the other. I'm not very good at squatting or deadlifting or snatch or clean and jerk. What exercises should I do to fix that? What things should I do? And, you know, the thing to me is funny is, like, well, why don't you just try practicing it more? Like, that's the first thought in my head. Like, if I was asking that question now, as all the experience I have and having done this stuff so much more, I would, if I wanted to get better at double unders in CrossFit, I'd spend 15 minutes doing double unders every day.
Right.
You know? And, like, if I just did a little bit of the thing and practiced, you'd get so much out of that. It seems like that's, like, almost lost now, the idea that, like, just practicing the thing you want to get better at is kind of like this weird, elusive, like, epiphany that someone's going to tell you that, you know, have you just tried doing it more?
Yeah, and I can tell you, just to go back and wrap up what I said about Mark Bell. Mark said to me one time, and you got to remember, when Mark had his powerlifting gym, it was, 800 square feet on the
small,
side of a CrossFit box.
Yeah.
And he told me one time, just back in 2010 or 2011, he said, they're going to raise my rent $400 a month. I'm going to have to close down. And I was like, what? You're going to have to close down? He's like, yeah, I can't afford it. And he couldn't afford it. He couldn't afford $400 a month to keep his gym open. And that's right about, he was still kind of working on the slingshot back
then. Yeah, I remember that.
And he brought it to market. He said, you know, I've got to do this. I've got to bring this to market. And sure enough, you know, and we'll talk about Mark's personal business, but last year he did over $3 million in business.
Wow.
This is from a guy who couldn't afford a $400 rent increase on his gym.
Yeah.
5 or 6 years prior. But Mark built that thing with consistency.
Yeah.
I had two kids come up. They just graduated from, I think, physical therapy school at the Arnold. They come up and talk to me. So how do we, you know, get started? And I said, well, you just have to start publishing. You have to start putting up content. Well, we're not Mark Bell. And I said, Mark Bell wasn't Mark Bell.
Yeah.
And never would have been if he didn't start putting up content. Yeah, exactly. Mark was really good about consistently putting up content. And the one thing Mark said to me, which I think is huge for the audience to know and for everybody to know, 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration, the devil's advocacy, the thing that kills most of our success is that, you know, we kill our own ideas,
right,
you know, with all the potential that things won't work. And Mark said to me, he goes, "I'm just too dumb to see the obstacles." And I'm thinking to myself, wow, I wish I were that dumb, because I probably would have been a lot more successful in a lot more things. Because I'm the kind of guy who wants everything to be perfect ahead of time, before you progress.
Right.
You know, and I'm worried about mitigating all the potential factors, things that could go wrong, before I even start.
Right.
So I think that's a pretty important thing. It's just, you just got to jump. You know, you got to get in there.
Yeah.
That is an interesting thing that comes with experience. That this will be... Eight years that will have had Juggernaut coming up in September.
Yeah.
And but really started working on it in June 2009. Graduated college, middle of May, started writing, what I thought was a business plan in June.
Yep.
And now looking back at it, I know it wasn't a business plan, but it was in kind of that same way. If I would have been able to foresee the headaches and stress and some of that, you know, it might have just scared me off at the start. But I was like, oh, this is going to be fun. It's going to be a gym, and I'm going to lift weights and get people strong. That's going to be great.
Yeah.
But you don't think about all the other stuff that comes along with it. And I guess that ignorance was
No, it's the same thing in training, though. Sure. You make a plan. Yeah. I'm going to train Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and I'm going to do these exercises, and I'm going to do this progression. And that's a plan.
Yeah.
And then you go about, you know, affecting the plan.
Right.
Do you have the same plan for your idea or concept or, you know, whatever business proposal? Did you write down a plan? Okay, I'm going to do this on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. And it's going to consist of these, you know, whether it be I'm going to make this many phone calls, I'm going to get this licensing, I'm going to, you know, produce this product, I'm going to develop this service.
Yeah.
And there's no plan in place. We have a plan to bench 500 pounds. But we don't have a plan to build a career.
I think a lot of people kind of miss the they think there's tools and there's work, and like having a plan. You could have the worst plan in the world for benching 500 pounds, but if you go in and you execute it and you follow through 100%. On the plan, you learn a lot. First, you learn it doesn't work well, but then you also learn, you know, okay, this is what I got to change for next time.
Yeah.
Rather than seeing, oh, this guy's got, you know, bands or chains, or he's got some special program or some tool.
Yeah.
Like, if you're not out there knocking on doors trying to sell your product, just trying to sell it with sheer willpower and you know, elbow grease, just everything you can to get it done.
Yeah.
The tools aren't going to help you.
No,
the tools are better advertising and salespeople.
Here we are having a conversation about another thing that Greg Knuckles just happened to write about today or yesterday on his page. He wrote that even the best design plans, you know, the percentage of one rep max progressions and all these other, you know, variables aren't going to be nearly as effective as the guy who is just consistent and works hard.
Yeah, Ed Cohen.
Yes.
Right? Ed Cohen, then you got like...
It's the intangibles.
Yeah, the other people that have...
Like we started the conversation with disciplines, consistency, hard work. Those are the intangibles, but people are trying to come up with this master scheme.
Yeah.
You know, if I cross this T and dot this I just enough times in just the right manner, then I'm going to be successful. And then you've got the Larry Wheels of the world that are just running in there like savages and just tearing things off the walls.
Right.
And look, you know,
he
got pretty friggin' strong.
Yeah.
So I think that's what you just said is hugely important. You have to do something. You have to practice. You have to consistently put in some marketing effort, knocking on doors. I built a $25 million a year business, started out knocking on doors.
Right.
You know, just out of my apartment, using the checkbooks that the credit card companies used to send you to write checks for my staff. That was their payroll.
Right, right.
I was paying my staff with credit card debt.
Right.
You know, and I only had three people, and we would knock on doors and sign up a customer. I just had a guy sat down with a friend of mine last week, and he wanted to start this business. And I said, well, it's not a business until you have sales.
Right.
I said, start pursuing sales. I said, has anybody bought your product yet? He said, well, I don't have my product, or I don't know how I'm going to make it, and blah, 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 blah. I said, we'll figure that out after the fact. If you can advertise, you have enough here to advertise it. You have enough here to put it out on a website. Take 20 orders and then go figure out how to make it.
Right.
You know, then you have a business. When you have income, you have a business.
Right.
Not when you have a lease, staff, sign on the door. That's not a business.
Yeah.
You know, income is business, not expenses.
Yeah, so many people just get held back by that step, the first step being the hardest step. And whether it's, you know, a fear of failing, you know, whatever it may be, right, there's tons of people with great ideas, you know, better ideas than what probably exists, but they don't have the courage or whatever it may be to take that first leap of faith and begin executing their plan. They make the plan, write it all down, but without the follow through of it, it's nothing.
Yeah. It's got to be every day.
Yeah,
it's got to be every day. My stepson was he got into algebra, and he was having a real hard time with algebra. So I sat down with him, I started working with him, and I watched him. He couldn't do 8 times 9 because the kids today, they use calculators.
Right.
So he didn't grow up doing the rote memorization, the times tables, all of that stuff, you know, like we used to do just over and over and over again. And that's what was hindering his progress. It was he had to fill in the gaps. So I took him to a program called Kumon, which is a math program. And it wasn't a matter of 3 months. It was, you know, it's 30 minutes a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a matter of 3 months he was at the top of his class.
Yeah.
You know, he just practiced. You know, he just consistently did something.
It's very true. It's very funny. The execution it trumps most things. I mean, with enough execution, you could probably do anything.
Yeah.
Right?
And some of it's shit you hate to do.
Sure. Yeah.
I talked about the fact that I had that mobility issue with my hip. I had hip impingement. And two different doctors did an MRI and gave me two different opinions, which were both surgery, hip replacement. They both told me. And it was keeping me up at night. It was so painful.
Yeah.
I could hardly sit in a car for an extended period of time. I couldn't go to a theater. You know, there's no way flying an airplane was next to impossible
because
the pain was so severe. And then I reached out to Eddie Cohn to get information on his doctor to get surgery. I wanted to find out who he got his hip replacement through. And he said, why don't you go see Mark Phillippe first? He's right there in town. Yeah. Mark Phillippe was the retired pro strongman that was head strength coach at UNLV. And I've talked about this lots of times, and I'll continue to talk about it because it's so important that I paid Mark to go in and work with him twice a week because I wouldn't do this stuff myself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a huge one.
It's a huge one. Yeah. People don't do it. They hear, what can I do for my shoulder? Well, here you go.
Yeah.
And then a month later, what can I do for my shoulder? Well, did you do the stuff I told you to do the last month?
Yeah.
No. They want some sort of passive treatment.
Right,
they want a shot, a pill, you know, an electric stimulation program. They want to, you know, they want something.
They just want someone to tell them it's
some
not possible.
ART. They can go in 15 minutes and walk out, and all of a sudden they're done. But I went through that mobility program, which I put Stan Efferding Mobility on YouTube, which was an hour twice a week.
Yeah.
And I went from not being able to squat at all. I mean, I'd completely given up. I was done. I'd quit.
Yeah.
Right? Not being able to squat at all. And within a month, my hip felt a lot better. And it wasn't just a couple months after that I squatted 900 and trained at Mark's.
This is like, 2014, 13?
Yeah, right in that time. And it was just a matter of actually doing it.
Right.
That's why I'm so adamant now when people talk to me about how, and I did that video on my Rhino's rant about the best way to recover from a workout. And I talked about blood flow and movement.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, things that are done to you or for you are not as effective as things you do for yourself.
Right.
And things like massage therapy or chiropractics or even ART aren't a solution. They're a gateway to the opportunity for you then to do the things that you need to do. ART allows you full range of motion. Well, now you need to use that motion in order to strengthen the muscles, break up the scar tissue, bring blood to the area. And I talk about my mom's shoulder surgery when she didn't bother doing her rehab and had frozen shoulder.
Yeah.
Use it or lose it.
Yeah,
and that is so true with the hips because, as you know, in all these powerlifting and strongmen and weightlifting movements, your body closes in around those movements. It strengthens around those movements like a boxer's shoulders.
Right.
And if you don't use opposition and you don't use mobility and you're not getting that range of motion, getting blood in there, then it's no different than if you put a cast on something or a brace on something. It's going to, you're going to minimize mobility and start to realize atrophy and lack of flexibility and motion,
yeah.
mobility.
Yeah. That's a very, all the tidbits and gems that people are getting are probably going to be missed, because so much of the stuff that you're saying, that we're saying comes from, you've got years and years of doing this. We've all sat here. There's a lot of experience coming out of working with a lot of people and seeing that stuff go down and seeing how to do things right and wrong. At the same time, doing it ourselves the wrong way, you know, probably more times than I'd wish to admit. But, you know, like so much of that stuff is all just those little tiny pieces. It's like, you know, again, another analogy, but like you're building a house, you're going to start one brick at a time, and it's those little tiny things. Because if you don't do all those little things, you don't take the time to put emphasis on practice or on the little stuff that you can actually go ahead and do, you miss out on a ton. But if you do put the energy into those little things, you get, you know, I mean, you get 10 times the return on it down the road, right?
That's not the way I ended up doing it, though.
No.
I didn't do it as a... prophylactic. I didn't do it in anticipation.
Yeah, of course.
You know, as long as we're on that topic. I waited till I got injured.
Yeah.
As most people do.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's cool if that's, you know, yeah. But there is a solution, is my point.
Well,
other than surgery and other than quitting.
And even with the rehab parts, and I've found myself doing this, herniated two discs in my back, really consistent, doing all the stuff that Dr. Quinn would give me with the breathing drills and everything. And then it starts to feel good, and I go from doing it, you know, every day to 4 days to 2 days
to once a week.
Once or twice this week, and then and then you heard it again.
Yeah.
Where if I could have stayed on the 2 times a week or whatever, it would avoid the next injury where you have to go back to doing it 7 days a week.
I'm the same way.
Yeah.
In the same way. No bigger prude than a reformed prostitute. Yeah, same way.
Trifecta provides pre-cooked organic food delivered right to your door weekly to help fit with your Renaissance diet, fuel your hard training, improve your recovery, and make your life easier. Visit trifectanutrition.com/juggernaut.
So that's recently weird. You've been working with one of the most amazing athletes out there, the Mountain, Thor Bjornsson.
Yeah, Hoff Thor Bjornsson. Boy, that's been an incredible ride. What an incredible athlete. You know, I talked about this, and I'll probably do a Rhino's rant on this in the future, but I'm gonna spill as much as we can talk about here to you, because it's a lot along the lines of what we just got done talking about. Here you've got one of the best athletes in the world. And I always worry a little when a guy reaches out to me and he's already an NFL ball player or an NBA ball player or plays MLS soccer or somebody like Hoff Thor at such a high level. You know, second in the world's strongest man. This guy's just a freak of all freaks.
Right. He
reaches out to you for help, and you're like, how can I help you?
Right.
You know what I mean? You've far outperformed anything I've ever done in my career. But then you start asking questions, and you find holes in their game.
Yeah.
And some of them are pretty significant. And you're like, why don't you fix that? Okay, I'll fix that. So we started going back and forth and finding out, and I asked him, why didn't you win World's Strongest Man? Just flat out, first question. And he kind of thought about it for a minute, and he said, I don't think I was my best. I said, well, why? He said, well, I travel a lot for Game of Thrones or for HBO. You know, he's all over the place, flying places. And so I started digging into, why was I successful? And I was successful because of the things I did outside the gym. That was one of the things that I was really, really good at. The eating and the sleeping and all the stuff that required me to be good inside. So every time I went to the gym to train, I was at peak performance. I was rested. I was hydrated. Right. I was well fed. I was recovered. So every single workout became almost euphoric because I was in there just at 100%. And as it turned out, he was not. His training was suffering. His competition would suffer. I didn't have anything to do with his programming, his lifting. Here's a guy who's already unbelievably strong. I wanted to make his body able to recover better. And what we found is that one of the things that Hoff Thor was doing is he was missing meals, missing sleep. He was flying, at these odd times. He would get in too late to places, so he didn't have a chance to get over jet lag, etc.
Yeah.
When I talked to Brian Shaw, he told me, he says, I can count on over 50 or 60% of the guys, at least half, probably more, that show up to the World's Strongest Man won't perform their best at their very best. Because they'll get there too late, be suffering from jet lag, they'll eat local food and drink local water, next thing you know, they'll be pissing out their ass, and they'll come in 10 pounds lighter.
Right.
They'll fatigue faster.
Right.
So he counted on that. So he gets there a week before, and he sends all his food.
I know that was a really big one for him in China maybe 3 years ago. There was like eight guys.
He's the only guy, right?
Yeah, who got food poisoning and were losing 20, 30 pounds.
Yeah, yeah.
And he sent all his own food over there and won.
Bingo. So we started looking into that. I talked to his manager, talked to his training partner, talked to his girlfriend. He said, here's the things we need to do for Hofthorne. You know, we need to handle the logistics of the whole thing. Fly a day earlier. Fly daytime flights instead of red eyes. Yeah. Don't have him on a 5 a.m. flight where he has to get up at 3. Make sure when he lands, he's got a hotel room that's got a kitchen and a fridge and a microwave. Make sure he's got food there. All of these things that some people might take for granted, when you're an elite athlete, those things become extremely important.
Yeah.
And then as for him physically, we went in, wanted to get a blood test. And some of the things I wanted to find out, he competed at the World's Strongest Man about 420 pounds. He had dropped down to 396, and he told me that it was to rest his body. Now, when I hear that, I'm thinking, well, you're not healthy. If you need to rest your body, you're not healthy. Because if you're healthy at 420, you don't drop to 396.
Right.
You know what I mean? And some of the things that can cause you not to be healthy are high blood pressure, high blood sugars, right? Those are two of the big key ones that can impede performance long term. So find out he's not wearing a CPAP. Well, there's the number one cause of at least identifiable blood pressure problems is CPAP and blood sugars, insulin resistance. Also, something I've talked about recently, and this is one of the things that I've been focusing on trying to get an ebook out on, is talk about the vertical dieting. This is something I learned from Flex Wheeler back in 2009. He was eating what I call a horizontal diet. Anything and everything just to get calories in.
Right.
You know, it was, you know, bacon and cheese and eggs and milk for breakfast with, pancakes or whatever else. It was just lots and lots of calories. And it might be fast food for lunch, it might be pizza for dinner, and then whatever else, you know, came in during the day. Horizontal dieting. And I think that it confuses the body. I think that you become really inefficient at processing all of the different varieties of foods. And it can cause a lot of insulin resistance. And therefore, now you're not shuttling nutrients to the muscles. It's becoming stored as fat. You're not recovering as fast from workouts. The carbohydrates aren't providing you the purpose that they're supposed to. So Flex, one of the things he had me do was do more vertical dieting, which means we narrowed down the food choices to a select few that were give me a high return on my investment, highly bioavailable things such as red meat, steak in particular. Maybe not even ground beef, certainly not like ground turkey, you know, soy, and they're just deficient in nutrients. If I'm going to go into the gym and want to get the best results from a leg workout, I'm going to squat. I'm not going to do leg extensions. So I'm going to eat red meat before I'm going to eat ground chicken. I just am, or even white fish or what have you. It's so much more loaded with nutrients that are so much more bioavailable, such as the heme iron and the creatine, the B vitamins, et cetera, and that your body utilizes that more efficiently. If you've trained your body to consume it in the quantities that you need to sustain growth. You know, basically, it's going to be enough calories. And the way to do that is you start with a particular amount of food, and then you grow that food over time. Flex had me start with 6 ounces of steak a meal, you know, 6 meals a day, a cup of rice, whatever. We keep it real slim here. And then he said, call me back when you're hungry. And so every week or 10 days I was hungry, he'd add 2 ounces of meat. Another 10 days, we'd add another 2 ounces of meat. Another 10 days, we'd add another meal, you know, maybe another cup of rice. I became really efficient at processing that food to the point where I was eating over 4 pounds, well over 4 pounds of steak a day. And I was utilizing all of it. I was dieting for a show and losing body fat, but holding my weight while we were training 2-a-days. So, and my insulin sensitivity was very good. I had blood tests, as you know from my history, I do blood tests all the time so I could see my hemoglobin A1C, I could see my blood sugars. Hofthor had a higher hemoglobin A1C. His blood sugars were elevated because of the varieties of foods he was eating, because of lack of sleep from the CPAP. And so what we did is start introducing the same concept of vertical dieting. And so I wanted him to be able to eat foods that his body would easily digest, and I wanted his digestive system to be prepared to digest that food very efficiently in large quantities. And so we went to gradually increase the amount of meat that he ate and the amount of rice that he ate. And in his case, and I don't do this in all cases, but because the goal was to gain weight, I would put dextrose on the rice. And I've noticed that I was just noticing your grind inter-workout product has dextrose in it. And the purpose of that is it's absorbed directly in the bloodstream. It's identical to glycogen, right? So you don't have to digest it. Unlike table sugar, right, which is 50% fructose, which has to be digested and is mostly stored in the liver after that. So I would have him sprinkle dextrose on the rice, and that made it made it so he could eat it better. It was easier to eat larger quantities of it. He would digest more of it faster. He'd be hungrier sooner. And because we eliminated some of those other problems by reducing the blood pressure and reducing bringing his insulin sensitivity, improving his insulin sensitivity, he was able to eat more food more often and gain weight. 420 at the World's Strongest Man, 396 when I got him, 455 at the Arnold Strongman.
Those training videos, especially the 195.
Yeah, he looks incredible. Clean and press.
Every single lift. Huge. Wow. Skyrocketed on a guy who you would think was pretty much at the top of his strength.
That's incredible. Curve.
He started having this improved performance because he was utilizing food better.
That's impressive.
Sleeping and eating better on a guy with that kind of talent. Yeah. He was recovering faster, able to lift heavy more often. Wow. Those were the key components to what we did for him. The vegetables that were in his diet were low-gas vegetables. I'm not a big fan of lots of broccoli, et cetera. Yeah. I talked about the oligosaccharides and then the gas and the bloating that you get as a result. It impedes protein absorption. It binds to valuable minerals and electrolytes, sodium, potassium, magnesium, zinc. Yeah. So I use what I call low-raffinose or low-gas vegetables, such as spinach and peppers. And then I noticed, who was it recently? It was drinking those chicken...
Blaine Sumner.
And I noticed that Blaine Sumner uses a lot of spinach throughout the day. And right. I don't know if that was by design or if he just noticed it didn't bloat him as bad or what have you. But vegetables can certainly be important. You have to be cautious about the amount of fiber that you take in because it can cause digestive problems and impede some of the absorption of these massive amounts of calories needed. And again, this is specifically for an athlete that's trying to gain weight and recover from these huge loads. I watch out for things like just things like bread and pasta and oats are fine in smaller quantities, but try and take in 800 grams a day of those, or 1,000 grams a day, which is what we tried to get Hofthor north of.
Holy shit.
Of carbohydrates to promote those kind of strength and size gains. I also had him implement was something that I think is really important, and he was a little hit and miss on this, but a 10-minute walk after every meal, at least 3 or 4 times a day. The research out of Australia showed that it drastically improved your insulin sensitivity, decreased bloating, sped the emptying of the gut. So now you could eat more food sooner.
Right.
So that was a real key. And then the movement, like I talked about previously, helped him with his recovery. Because he wasn't, I've always found that when the more I laid around, I would get worse. I would get sore. And anybody said, what can I do for this, delayed onset muscle soreness? And I, move.
Yeah.
Get on that bike, that recumbent bike, put a little tension on it, start to spin, get some blood flow, the knees start to feel better. Well, that's a whole other discussion with respect to what you can do to improve your knees just with movement through a full range of motion.
Right.
And a lot of power lifters don't squat. And I probably wouldn't recommend for a power lifter, they need to squat as deep as the judges require. Anything more than that probably will compromise performance. But that doesn't mean you should never go through that range of motion because the same problem starts to occur. And if you're not using it, then how do you strengthen? Eventually you're going to create a problem where you're going to have injuries. Yep. So not to get off track, but those are all the things that we implemented with Hofthor, some other minor things I probably just can't think of off the top of my head, but it was extraordinary.
That's impressive because it's not really it's obviously drastic changes, but there's nothing really there that's
It's the little thing.
There's nothing radical. You're not saying we had one of this Himalayan rice that you have to like hike in the mountains
some and get.
You
know, and
Dominican avocados.
There was, and I said that in a recent rant too. You don't have to eat 50 different foods from 27 different countries or some special berry or from a tropical island. It just, if you're out there searching for something like that, you're looking in the wrong place.
Yeah.
I really believe that.
Yeah, it's just mastering the basics of it. Like you're talking about eating steak and rice and lifting
and
hard
seems
and sleeping
simple,
well.
But you might lift four times, five times a week. You're eating six times a day.
Right.
You know, where are the chances that you're going to go sideways? True. You're going to go wrong. You know,
that's true.
That's a lot harder. So it's been exciting, and he's been very cooperative and very interested. Another thing that we did is his vitamin D. He was low on vitamin D as well. Vitamin D has an inverse relationship with blood sugars. The higher your vitamin D, the lower your hemoglobin A1C. There's been plenty of research studies to suggest that's key for improving insulin sensitivity, is getting your vitamin D up. And I did a rant where I talked about the steroid that everybody should be taking.
Yeah.
And it's vitamin D, because it's not a vitamin. It's a sterol. It's a steroid precursor.
Right.
And it's huge. Increased to, another thing is that he was healthy. He wasn't exposed to, a lot of times, as we know, as power lifting athletes, that you get sick pretty often. You're suppressing your white blood cell count from all the overload and your central nervous system and all that other stuff. And I always laugh because I was the same guy. I would show up to a meet. I was always sick.
Yeah.
How many times have you seen people get sick at a meet?
I get sick right after a meet.
Right after.
Yeah. I've seen that with Milanchev.
A lot of guys.
At the last meet I did in Australia at Big Dogs, where he broke the squat record and broke the total record again. He came in 2 days before, very sick, fever, throwing up in the warm-up room, in between sets, head buried in a trash can kind of situation.
Well, gang, and I haven't been, I haven't tried to hide the fact that performance-enhancing drugs can cause those kinds of things to increase in likelihood. It's a very real effect, those flu-like, kind of cold-like symptoms, the stuffy head, sore throat sort of things can happen, and it's dose-dependent, and particularly with certain oral products, the liver enzymes start to shoot up. And that's what's responsible in many cases for people becoming more susceptible to colds. So that has a huge effect. And how do you combat that if you intend to compete in a sport where everybody's doing that and you've chosen to do that? You need to do all the things right outside the gym. You need to sleep better with a CPAP. You need to get your blood pressure down. You need to get your insulin sensitivity right. And the vitamin D helped with increasing his white blood cell count and reducing his susceptibility to colds. His immune system was improved, and that became really important.
Probably the vitamin D issues. The sun never shines in Iceland.
I was going to say that.
It's dark like 18 hours a day for part of the year.
And I said in my rant, I got to say it again, it's not something you could just take it in a week, you're fixed.
Yeah.
My vitamin D was at 30, which is the bottom end of the range. 30 to 100 is the accepted kind of normal range.
Yeah.
And I took 10,000 IUs for a month, and it only went up to 36.
Oh, okay.
Took 10,000 IUs for another month consistently, and it went up to 45. Took it for another month consistently, went up to 54.
So you're all telling me you got to be consistent with it?
You got to be consistent with it. Yeah. There's some things you could take, and remedy a deficiency much quicker. But vitamin D is not one of those things. It takes a significant amount of time. And I realized improvements the whole time. Throughout my powerlifting career, I would get a cold every 3 or 4 months or some sort of, annoying, hack or head cold or whatever else. And I just accepted that as being part of the stresses that I put myself through, the extra weight that I had, the performance-enhancing drugs I was taking, and the training, how hard the training was. And it didn't have to be that way. I look back in retrospect now, and you can combat that by doing... by doing the blood test, improving the things that are deficient. I can remember I've had one very short cold since November of 2015. Never in the past, I couldn't tell you how many times I would get a cold in a year. It would be 4 or 5 times a year.
Yeah.
And I've got kids at home running around, coughing and sneezing and all this other stuff. I can remember back to the last time I had a significant cold was November 2015. And I spoke about that in my rant at the time, saying that I was feeling run down, I was feeling beat, my bones were starting to ache. You know, I'd go in and just doing dips.
Yeah.
My bones were hurting, you know. Obviously, vitamin D improves calcium absorption. I don't know if it was that big a deal, but I was feeling terrible. And when I started that vitamin D, everything changed. So,
wow.
I don't mean to belabor the point, but I'm saying that these things are that important.
Yeah.
If it took an athlete like Hofthor at the top of his game, and next thing you know, he's deadlifting, 968 and overhead pressing 4.25 for reps and setting a world record in the 100-pound bag and then in the 45-pound one-arm
throw. Yeah, no one's close to him on that one.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous to see that kind of performance just from, like you said, from the logistics. Just
little things, right?
The little things.
Done really well, right? And just the execution of those little things, right?
And he's disciplined.
Yeah.
That's the thing. A lot of times I'll tell people to do these things, and they'll come back a month later and they haven't changed, and I'll ask them, are you doing these things? I call those people ask holes, by the way. And if you ask me something and I tell you and you don't do it, then don't ask me anymore.
Right.
You're
right.
An ask hole.
Yeah.
Problem is today, with all the information that's out there and all the trainers and all this, that, and the other, people go get, you know, like I told you earlier, they'll get seven different people to tell them what to do.
Right.
And they'll kind of just pick and choose or not even do any of it.
Yeah.
In my experience.
I think it's so rare, too, for someone like Thor, who's clearly exceptionally talented.
Mm-hmm.
And probably has had a lot of his success come relatively easy. That he was better than everyone else when they, you know, when he started training for Strongman, the guy he was with went like this, and he just kept going.
Yeah.
And it's probably easy for those type of people to overlook the details because they've been so successful, they've been so great, and probably what really separates the ones who become the legends, the best ever. The ones who accept that it's not just their own natural ability that's making them this way, but being able to improve upon those things.
And that's Brian Shaw. That's somebody who's not only talented, but extremely disciplined.
Yeah.
The logistics of the whole thing, the intangibles, he's on it.
Yeah.
And so that's what it's going to take to compete at that level.
Did you work with Brian, too?
I didn't. No,
okay.
No. I just had the opportunity to talk to him, and I've watched all the stuff that he did. You know, I want to find out what the best people in the world did. That's why I went and trained with Flex Wheeler.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's why I went and trained with Mark Bell, Eddie Cohn. I wanted to find out
exactly
how they did it. And more you discover, A, they have a predisposition. These guys are genetically very talented. B, they trained very, very, very hard. But C, they were extraordinarily disciplined over an extended period of time.
Yeah.
You know, and that's all the little things.
Yeah, it's super important to put yourself in a place where you can, where you... like you just said, like learning from those people, because you don't wonder about it afterward, right?
Right.
You always question, well, what did Ed Cohn really do? Mm-hmm. And if I can only imagine what it's like now for a kid getting into this stuff where you go online and you're bombarded by people trying to sell you a product or sell you a thing, and you don't really know exactly what is going on. And it's confusing because, you know, you're not sure. You're starting from nowhere. But having spent the time to go and learn from these people or meet these people, you quickly like, okay, I get it. You pick up so much more when you're actually with them too, because you understand when they tell you something that was written down and it comes across to you with a different tone, the amount to which they emphasize certain things, like, oh yeah, I just kind of added weight every week.
It's different
than
that.
If someone says, well, I wrote out my training cycle 100 times till it looked exactly the way I thought it should be, and then I did that one.
I've been following Flex Wheeler since the late 80s. And when I finally got to sit down with him in 2008, this is after having driven down to Gold's Venice many times over the years and watched those guys train and what have you. I had my big yellow pad of paper sitting down and my pencil out, and I was like, oh, yeah, this is it. The Wizard of Oz is going to pull back the curtain and tell me and, you know, all the levers. And I thought, when I get out of here, this shit's going to change.
You'll have a whole plan.
Yeah. We sat and ate lunch for an hour, and he talked, and we talked, and I asked questions. I had nothing written on the piece of paper.
Yeah.
He didn't tell me anything I didn't know.
Yeah.
Not one thing. No magic drug protocol, no super supplement, no nothing special. What he told me is what is happening right now in Kuwait at Oxygen Gym, which everybody thinks is this magical pro maker, right? Eat, sleep, and train.
Right.
That's what he told me. in Kuwait, that's all you do when you go there and train with those guys.
Right.
There's no partying. There's no women. There's no – you train twice a day. You eat eight times a day. You sleep 10 hours a day. Yeah. That's what you do. And when I went down and trained with Flex, that's what we did. And you train very, very hard.
Yeah.
And when I trained with Flex, that's what we did. We trained extremely hard. I mean, he pushed me to my limit. And I had a guy out there, Keith Williams, to train with me. And we competed on every single set. We would keep track of every rep, the depth, the rest time, you name it, so that, you know, nobody had an advantage. We pushed that. And that was twice a day. We would take a 20 or 30-minute nap after we ate after each workout, and we'd sleep at least 9 hours a night.
Yeah.
We had a massage therapist almost on a daily basis down there to help with recovery. And we ate at least eight times a day. I told you, north of 4 pounds of steak and 800 grams of carbs a day. Every single day, around the clock, that's all we did, eat, sleep, train, eat, sleep, train. And I talked about this in one of my rants, and that's where the success came from. There was no magic. And I've said, too, that I'm not a big supplement guy. I didn't take any supplements when I was training with Flex. Any protein powders, you know, any creatine. I didn't take training that. And I didn't take any of that when I was training with Mark Bell when I did my powerlifting. And I got my pro card with Flex and didn't take a single protein powder, creatine, whatever else. Doesn't mean I don't like supplements.
Sure.
Well, you were eating 4 pounds of steak.
I was eating 4 pounds of steak. Yeah. So what did I mean? What was I deficient in?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's some things I use now because they taste good and they're convenient.
Yeah.
You know, I use it was interesting. It's the first time I've looked at your ingredients on your product. What's the name of that one that you use for the intra workout? The grind.
The grind diesel.
Just for fun, you know, I go over and I look at the ingredients. I always do that.
Yeah.
And most of the time I'm like, this is shit.
Right.
But I look at the ingredients and it's pretty much exactly what I drink before and during my training session every day.
Yeah.
The dextrose.
Right, right.
A little whey isolate. The BCAAs. I pour in a little more sodium. But I know that people freak out about that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a big sodium guy from my rant. And that's not for your sedentary grandmother. That's for athletes who are training, you know, really hard every day or twice a day. I'm a big fan of sodium. It's huge for my endurance and stamina. But that's what I drink. And it almost, other than you got a little flavor in there, that's exactly what's in your can. And I was like, damn, this is...
Yeah.
Chad might be a smart guy. He looks pretty stupid, but he's probably a pretty bright guy to have created this product. And I do programs for people, and that's almost exactly what I tell them to take. And they're like, well, which BCAA do I take? And which, you know, which that?
Right.
And so now I'll just say, just take diesel from Grind. And that's not an ad, and Chad doesn't pay me for this. I'm just saying that I take some supplements.
It was Dr. Mike Isertel who designed the products.
Okay.
I'm just the face.
Okay.
The body. Yeah.
Well, there you have it. So,
yeah,
you know, they're convenient, and they taste good. And you know, I think that you can do so much more with nutrition than I think most people are doing.
Yeah,
I think that seems like as good a place to end as any. A ringing grind endorsement from Stan Efferding.
I got another hour worth of material. I mean, is this it? Mark usually lets me go for 4 hours.
Well, there's an hour and a half before show, so
that's great. What's coming up next for you?
You know, it's just the same old thing. I've got a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old at home. I love to train. I love, you know, hanging out with my kids. And I've been traveling a lot more than I wanted to in the past with the cooler and the Shark Tank airing. Now we've got so many opportunities developing. I just love the training that I'm doing, staying healthy. And so I really don't have any plans. I'm just taking it as I go. I've got going to Samoa next week, actually Monday. Be in Samoa for a week. We're doing some seminars down there and meeting the governor and doing some radio shows and stuff. I did that rant about the obesity epidemic in Samoa, and they're really interested in meeting me and talking to me. And I'll be in Seattle the week after that. I think I'm doing a seminar with Eddie Cohn.
Okay.
Where? I don't know. I forgot off the top of my head, but somewhere. And then I'll be in Canada.
Wait until you get the email notification.
Yeah.
You can now check in for your flight.
I feel bad. I should recall, but I have so much coming up. And I'll be in Canada the week after that doing another seminar. And so it's been pretty busy. It's been pretty busy.
Where can people find you, find the cooler?
StanEfferding.com, thecooler.com with a K, at Stan Efferding's Instagram, and Stan Efferding on Facebook, so it's all out there.
Fantastic.
Very good. You can find me on Instagram at Max_Ada, or on Facebook, or email me, max@jtsstrength.com.
Make sure that you go to store.jtsstrength.com, the events section, if you want to find upcoming events with Max and myself. Max will be in New Zealand, conducting a couple of clinics while he's out there for Masters World Weightlifting Championships. Dr. Mike, Dr. James, Dr. Quinn, and not Dr. Chad will be in Arlington, Texas at the Juggernaut Performance Summit on April 30th, talking about programming, nutrition, movement, and recovery. Stan pretty much nailed all those. That's kind of the four things that really matter, not so much the little small stuff besides it. So see you there. We'll be in Texas, Brazzers something, Brazos Valley Barbell for Max in College Station, and myself at FTA Gym in Austin with Marissa. Clearly, I think you know what the Better Looking seminar will be the first weekend in June. Beyond that, subscribe to our YouTube channel. We are very, very proud of the quality of content we produce on there. And if you like the podcast, go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review. Oh, yeah. I'm Chad Wesley Smith, at Chad Wesley Smith and at Juggernaut Train on Instagram and Facebook, filling up your news feeds all day. Until the next time, thank you very much, sir. Yeah.